même façon. Je commence par la note du haut.
This is a rendition of Schubert's Piano Trio No. 2 in E flat major, second movement, from the film Piano Teacher, directed by Michael Haneke, starring Isabel Huppert, whose performance is so striking as it is an accurate portrait of my own Russian piano teacher, performing the Schuberts, the Schumanns, and other Eurocentric musical studies continues its political soft powers over time, effortlessly, thanks to a whole generation of Asian tiger moms. Even though I was born on the island of Taiwan, which is 9,000 kilometers away from Europe, I was already weaned on the genius of baby Mozart and Bach. I was instilled the emotions and feelings of Chopin and Debussy because Mama knew best. As I go through my own journey of decolonization, unpacking my own upbringing, one big chapter is that of parenting. The infamous tiger mom of so many Asian children.
The tiger mom debate has captured the attention of parents all across the country. From the cover of Time magazine to the bestseller list, Amy Chua's book, Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother, about strict Asian parenting has exploded. Now our Juju Chang sat down with the author to talk about this uproar.
Chinese immigrant parents force their preschool children to do 1 hour a day on average of a focused activity. That could be reading, drawing, but doing something with no distractions. 1 hour on average a day compared to just 6 minutes a day for Americans on average.
But does this obedient sitting and drilling kill the creativity that leads to real innovation?
As someone who survived the tiger mom childhood experience, I still suffer PTSD decades after. But today I'd like to share with you a different perspective of parenting.
Hi, this is Iris Chen, author of Untigering.
She's a peaceful parenting advocate, intersectional unschooler, anti-oppression activist, and a tiger mom deconstructionist.
Hi.
You're listening to Asian Provocation, and this is your host, Ayoto Tarakya. Thank you for taking the time for this interview and conversation.
Sure.
I've been really excited to speak with you about your book, Untigering. It's been really, really inspirational, but at the same time, super triggering.
Mm-hmm.
Your book is packed with not only tools, but many accurate descriptions of the tigering experience. As you wrote, you had all the potential to become a tiger mom yourself. What was the turning point for you to come to this awareness and the desire to write this book? Did you go through therapy, or was it specific books or training? How did you have that kind of awareness?
It was definitely a process. I didn't go through formal therapy, but there was definitely, like, as I grew older, more self-awareness, more of a willingness to examine my own wounds and my own pains that I grew up with. And I really think it was my children that forced me into that because, or it's just relationships in general, right? Like when we're on our own, we think we're doing well and we don't realize that we have a lot of stuff to work through. So that happened also when I got married. Like marriage brought up a lot of stuff for me. I thought I was like totally fine, that I didn't have a lot of issues to work through. And then once I got married, all these things came up. And I think it was the same with parenting. It's like once I started having kids and they started being their own people and outside of my control, I realized how much pain I was still holding and how my reactions to their behavior was so disproportionate, and realizing that there is something else going on there, like other buttons that were being pushed because of things that had happened in my own childhood, especially my relationship with my older child, where I was just trying to control him so much and he would not be controlled.
Yeah.
And I think just exposing, why do I have that desire? What is it about me that makes it so upsetting when he doesn't do what I tell him to do, or he can't calm down, or all those things? So yeah, I think once I began to understand that a lot of my reactions and issues were not about my child, but were about me, then I was able to just unpack that a little bit more, to take responsibility instead of projecting that responsibility onto my child. Because for the longest time, I thought it was like my kids were making me upset. They were like driving me up the wall, right? But realizing it was my own baggage, my own triggers that was causing me to interpret his behavior in that way. And I think once I was able to unpack that, having so much more compassion for my children, understanding why they were behaving the way they were, understanding the needs that were underneath those behaviors instead of just labeling them and placing a judgment on them.
Where did you grow up?
That's a tricky question because I've been all over, but I was born in the States in California, and then my family moved to Canada. So I lived in Canada for a total of 9 years. So my younger childhood years were all in Canada. And then when I was 12, I moved back to the States and grew up there until I got married. And then a few years after marriage, my husband and I went out to China and lived there for 16 years. So in fact, China is where I have lived the longest in my entire life, at least in terms of like one city. That was the longest place I've lived anywhere.
Which city was that in China?
It's Tianjin, which is a big city near Beijing.
And why did you and your husband decide to go to Tianjin for 16 years?
It's funny because even though it's such a huge city, nobody has ever really heard of Tianjin. Mm. It's sort of like the forgotten younger sibling of Beijing. We were actually just sent there with a teaching organization. So we went as English teachers to universities, and the organization that we went with sent us there. So we actually knew nothing about Tianjin. We didn't choose it for ourselves, but we were just sent there to a university in that city and ended up staying because we loved it so much.
16 years. And then you had your first child there?
Yeah. So all our kids were born in China and have lived all their lives there up until a few years ago when we moved back to the States.
What age were they when they moved to the States?
They were 9 and 11. So yeah, their formative years were really overseas.
I had a similar experience. My parents were in their mid-30s and I was 7 when we immigrated to Australia. How was that for you and for the kids?
I think that really shaped me in a lot of ways. And it wasn't until I was older, you know, maybe as a young adult, that I was able to recognize how difficult that was for me. Because I think it made it difficult for me to form lasting relationships or to get attached to people because I was always trying to protect myself. I was afraid of losing those close relationships. And so I didn't want to get attached because it was too painful to leave. And so I really saw how it hardened my heart in ways so that it was difficult to be intimate with people, to feel connected with people, to build friendships.
But what about with your husband? What was the connecting factor for you guys?
We went to school together, so we were part of a Christian fellowship in college, and so that's how we connected. That was the connecting point for us at that time.
Are you still part of the same Christian fellowship together and working in that field?
Oh, so that was like back in college. That was just a college fellowship. It's not something that like after you graduate, you know, you go on and become more involved in your churches or whatever. But no, like we're not involved with that group anymore. And our beliefs have shifted a lot since those years. So we're sort of on a different path now.
That's another big topic. The relationship for Asians in diaspora and Christianity. What is the relationship for you and your kids now with spirituality? Do you speak to them about that?
I actually grew up a child of a pastor. So my dad was a pastor for many years. So we grew up in a very religious household, very conservative. And as an adult, recognizing some of the toxicity of that, the control and the fundamentalism of that way of thinking. And I actually still identify as a Christian. There's many parts of it that I feel are very radical and just spiritually that I can connect to because that's my upbringing. That's sort of the spiritual language that I grew up with and can connect to. But I've really tried to divest from a lot of the toxic elements of it and really don't prescribe to a lot of the things that maybe fundamental Christians would consider orthodox Christianity, like, oh, you need to believe this particular thing in order to be considered Christian. And a lot of those things I just don't believe anymore. And I feel like there's a lot of freedom in that. For me, the fundamental thing is seeing God or the source, the universe, as loving and, yeah, as having this unconditional love for us. So that is really the core of the message that I believe in. And so that's what I try to communicate to my kids as well. So it's less about rituals. It's less about, you know, being morally upright and all these things, but just living in love and sharing this love with other people. And I think that ties in a lot with peaceful parenting and untigering that I write about, because untigering, it was really my process of moving away from believing that my worth or my children's worth had to do with their accomplishments, had to do with their performance, with fitting in these boxes that I expected of them, and really moving instead towards like loving them unconditionally as people, no matter how they showed up in the world. And so that really mirrored my spiritual transformation as well, I think.
Were you able to have some of these conversations with your father, and like, how's that relationship progressed with some of these developments in yourself?
I don't know if we had, because I was sort of deconstructing when I was overseas in China. And so, you know, there was that distance. We didn't have those conversations very often. But I think he knew, because of different circumstances, that our beliefs were shifting. But I think there was still enough commonality there to find common ground, even though my beliefs are very different. I think part of it is not approaching it in a fundamental way, a dogmatic way, which is the way I grew up, right? Like, if you don't believe what I believe, then I'm going to cut you off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's what I saw a lot in my circles. And so I didn't want to approach him in the same way, where it's like, okay, since you don't believe what I believe, then I can't have a relationship with you. It was really about, I want the freedom to believe what I believe. And I'm going to give you the freedom, of course, to believe what you believe too. And we're going to try to maintain this relationship with that tension, and hopefully love each other through it.
That's so rare in today's ever-polarizing society. It's becoming so difficult to relate to the parable of loving your enemy, the ability to just listen to one another. One of the themes of this podcast is that of sexuality, which you bring up in your book, is the discussion around homophobia, transphobia, and the relationship with the LGBTQ plus community. This is one of those topics that I personally had a really difficult time with my own parents. They didn't really have the tools nor the understanding, and there was a lot of tension and shame around that. Your kids are now around the age of puberty. How do you touch on these topics with your kids, given your background and your own journey? How do you bring up these subjects with your children?
So a lot of what I call the untigering process is really about learning new tools, or about doing things that we never saw modeled to us. And I think especially growing up in a Chinese family in particular, you know, peaceful parenting isn't generally modeled for us, or emotional attunement, or difficult, awkward conversations about sex. So we really have to blaze our own trails in some ways and learn from others, find tools to make it work for us. And so if I believe in sex positivity, it's not because I grew up with that type of mindset. It's because I've had to really shift my thinking and find the resources that I need in order to have those conversations with my kids. And so that's why I feel, especially for Asian parents who are trying to practice peaceful parenting, we need so many resources because we don't have those culturally relevant models for us.
Mm-hmm.
I just recently posted something on my social media about how my parents actually took me out of sex ed and you know, gave me, like, signed me out so I wouldn't have to attend. And I never had the conversation with them, really. They sort of gave me a book to look at. And now, especially because I'm raising boys, I feel there's so much education that needs to happen around consent, around like just knowledge so that they're not ignorant, and how to not internalize shame about sex. And so I've really tried to have those hard conversations, just exposing them to different media, different books where there are characters with who are sexual minorities or who are trans or whatever it is, and not placing a judgment on them, but just exposing them and saying that this is a reality, and also communicating to our kids like really upfront that no matter what they choose in their life, that we will always love them, that they can talk to us about anything, that sex is supposed to be enjoyable, it's good. And if you have questions about it, talk to us about it. Here are some books. So it is awkward. And sometimes my kids are like, stop talking to us about this. You told us about this already that one time. And for me, realizing like, it's not a one-time conversation. We need to continue to keep, you know, the lanes of communication open. So yeah, it's been a lot of work and a lot of getting over the awkwardness of it. But I think it's just one of those things. The more we do it, the more natural it becomes and the less awkward. So yeah, I just encourage all the parents out there, even though it's hard, to still find a way to have those conversations with your kids.
There's an important part of your book where you touch on Maslow's hierarchy of needs and its colonialist whitewashing background.
Mm-hmm.
Can you speak on the connection with the Blackfoot Nation?
Just as I was doing different research, I found out that Maslow went to observe the Blackfoot Nation in Alberta, Canada, which is actually where I grew up in Canada, and then took those principles and made it into something that was very individualistic. So if for those who are familiar with the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, it's sort of like this pyramid. And at the very top is self-actualization. And at the bottom are like more basic needs, you know, like for safety, security, like your basic physical needs. And then it goes up to different more like emotional needs. And at the very top is self-actualization. But what I discovered in my research is that he took this from the Blackfoot Nation, but the Blackfoot Nation, it was actually imagined as like a teepee. And at the top wasn't just individual self-actualization, but it was what they called cultural perpetuity, which is a continuation of their culture and of the collective ideals of their community. And at the bottom was actually self-actualization. And so just seeing the way we view ourselves through a Western lens sometimes is that it is all about me. It's about how I feel about things and about my happiness. But in a more collective society, it's like that is important. Like our personal desires and autonomy and all that is important. But we also need to see all of that in the context of the collective and how we are part of a community and how can we serve this community. So it's not just about ourselves, but also about our connection to others. And so I really loved that because, you know, just being an Asian American and feeling this tension between a collective society and an individualistic one, but there are ways to just imagine our existence so that they aren't necessarily polarizing, that we can live in that tension of expressing and valuing our individuality. And in so doing, that actually helps us as a collective, as a society, become better when each of us are allowed to freely be who we were meant to be.
Please take a look at the illustration provided for this episode for a visualization of Maslow's hierarchy of needs compared to the Blackfoot Nation's concept, which he borrowed from. There seems to be an oversimplification of the idea of East versus West. Eastern culture is supposedly a communal, Confucius concept, while Western the proponent of individualism. But has the world ever produced ever only two alternatives? Is this really what it's coming down to? Individual or communal? To realize and discover Maslow's proposed theory was this oversimplification on a whole different paradigm and perspective. Another chapter of whitewashing and the creation of the Western myth. To have the self-actualization as a basic starting block, and to grow into community actualization, and finally cultural perpetuity. To expand on concepts of time and having multiple dimensions of reality. And we wonder about the increasing isolation and the separateness we have from one another in this modern society. I wonder what other paradigms have we lost due to simplification and progressive modernization. You also mentioned that you're part of a Buy Nothing group in your community.
Yeah, I'm actually not the one who is organizing it. They already exist and I just joined them. So I think it's like this international organization called Buy Nothing. And it's these micro local communities where you just gift things that you don't need. Yes, it's like a gift economy rather than a business or buying economy. And that really appealed to me, just to like resist the capitalistic greed that, you know, we're indoctrinated into. But learning to share freely with other people, not to hoard, to know that we as a collective do have the resources to help each other and to also ask for help when we need it. So that's really been a community that I've appreciated.
It's really an interesting the way you're approaching capitalism. It's also easy to speak about it in theory, but in practice it's such a different challenge. Another interesting observation you mentioned in your book is the discussion of China's bystander problem. These myths of how we're all having to deal with living on this planet. When I was in China, I remember the time I was involved in a motorbike accident after a near collision with an oncoming driver in a car. I swerved, and in doing so, I slid across the road. With a slight concussion and bloody face, I remember being surrounded by people, but nobody helped.
Wow.
The driver from the car came to see, and instead of checking in on me, he simply yelled, "Kai mai dia," or "drive slower."
Wow.
He returned to his car and drove off. Nobody said anything or helped me get back on my bike.
Wow.
Recently, with the endemic situation as it gets worse, I see a similar occurrence in Europe and the United States as well. I suspect that there's a growing sentiment of insecurity and the increase of competition in resources and the rise of nationalism. How is your family dealing with the current climate of anti-Asian hate and general societal isolation and alienation?
I mean, we are stuck at home, so we haven't been going out that much. But when we do, I know for myself, I do feel anxious, you know, because the attacks have been completely random and it's very disconcerting. It's very, yeah, it causes anxiety, at least for me. And I know that we ended up buying pepper spray just so that when we go walk around the neighborhood or just whenever we leave our home, we always have it on us now. And it's really sad that we have to live in this environment of fear. You know, yeah. I think, it's just very discouraging. And I knew that because I lived in China for so long, I could blend in, you know, my race was not an issue. And I knew as we prepared to come back, it was sort of in the middle of the Trump administration and we were seeing what was happening. I did not look forward to that. I was not looking forward to moving back into a country where the race tensions were so fraught and I knew that I would be a target and that many other people are targets. But at the same time, it was so important for me to come back and sort of be a part of hopefully bringing about change. And I don't even know what that looks like, you know, other than speaking up against it and making people more aware. But I know for my kids, talking about it, I don't think it's anything that they have experienced yet because we've only been here for a few years and like, one whole year of that was stuck inside our house. But, you know, both my husband and I grew up experiencing racism. And so that's part of our story. And probably the longer our kids live here, that will be part of their story too. So needing to make them aware of that, needing to expose them, make them aware of just the history of our nation and how it was founded and our connection to other marginalized groups and their struggle, you know. So those are all conversations that we have and it's important to make them aware of. And I don't think that that's a lot, that's not a conversation that most of us have had with our immigrant parents because they, for the most part, don't necessarily know the history. They're just sort of thrown into a situation where it's sink or swim. They're just trying to survive. And they, of course, probably do experience racism, but maybe they just consider that you know, part and parcel of the immigrant experience and don't have the language to help us process that or talk about that. Yeah, these are all conversations, though, that I think are really important to have with our kids, especially with the rise in anti-Asian hate. It's been more of an opportunity for the Asian community in the States to speak up. And I think that's another thing where maybe in the past, there's been shame associated with it or just a lack of a forum, maybe language barriers. But now there are a lot of ways to make the wider community aware of these situations, you know, now with social media, with all the cell phones that are, you know, recording these incidents. There's a lot more awareness that's being brought to this situation.
There seems to be a development of an Asian variation of the talk that Black families go through with particularly sons, but for the children in general. There's a reminder of the horrible systemic racism in society that they face and the way that Asian families, I believe, do have a different issue. But this talk, yeah, like you said, I never had that either. Mm-hmm. Growing up in Australia, my parents were just trying to survive and they have their own coping mechanisms.
Mm-hmm.
I remember talking to them about experiences of racism, but it felt almost embarrassing or shameful.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember my parents, they were almost more curious and confused than upset. I remember them asking me like, so how do you feel and what did you do about it? But there wasn't much follow-up or suggestions or assistance in dealing with these situations. If anything, I think worst cases is more gaslighting or saying, well, you know, you got to watch out for yourself and this kind of perspective. But mm-hmm. it's really a new period and awareness.
Having two sons, do you have some of these observations and discussion in terms of socializing and interacting with their surroundings? How long have they been in the States?
Almost 2 years.
Mm-hmm. And in these 2 years, do you guys discuss like the difference between them growing up in China?
Yeah, definitely. You know, we talk about their experience in China versus here. But again, I think a lot of it they have not seen or experienced in person because we've just been on lockdown for a big chunk of the time and they've just been home with us. You know, because we were part of sort of like the foreign community as well as the local community in China, their identity, you know, they're considered what we call third culture kids. So I don't know if they totally identify with being American. You know, they probably don't really identify with being that because they never grew up here, even though they grew up speaking English, but they don't identify with being Chinese either because they weren't like the local kids either. So I think as they grow up, they will need to figure out what that means for themselves, their own ethnic, racial identity, and where they feel a sense of belonging and connection with people. But talking with them about just current events, things that we are seeing unfold in our nation and the history behind that, I think they're very aware of the tensions and the hate and the history of where all that is coming from.
What's their social circles like? Is it all online or through school? What kind of people do they hang out with?
Sure. So right now we're just at home. And so a lot of their friends are online, which has been, you know, a blessing in disguise because they're still able to keep in touch with some of their friends from China. And they haven't lost touch with them because everything right now is online anyway. But yeah, there have been different groups that they've connected with as well, like through the church community that we're part of. But because we came in, but we moved in during COVID. And so in some ways, they weren't able to connect with kids the way they normally would because of the situation. Like we just had to keep our distance. So that was something that was really sad because now we've been here for a year and it feels awkward to try to build those relationships. But hopefully once things get more under control and things get lifted, that there will be opportunities to connect more with the kids around them. But we are an unschooling family, so they don't go to traditional school. They're at home with us. And hopefully, yeah, again, once coronavirus is more under control, there'll be more opportunities for them to socialize and connect with other kids.
Can you describe a bit more what unschooling is like?
Sure. So unschooling is what I just consider natural life learning, consent-based learning, self-directed learning. So those are all words that I use to describe it. It's the belief that children are naturally curious, that they are natural learners. So we as the adults don't need to come in and impose learning on them or have our own ideas of what they need to learn, but to empower them to follow their own passions and to really be a coach and a guide and a support to them instead of the traditional schooling model where you have these standards that they need to learn at a certain age and you divide up learning into different subjects. It's really not like that at all. It's pretty much living life without this concept of school. So it is pretty radical because most of us have grown up in a traditional schooling environment, including my husband and I. But I think it was an overflow of our ideas or our ideals of peaceful parenting, which is about accepting our child as they are, about autonomy, respect, honor, love, all those things. And so really seeing that in a traditional schooling environment that they are not offered that, they're not offered bodily autonomy, respect, or any of those things. And we're learning to just be with children in a completely different paradigm where they are seen as partners and as having the same freedoms that we as adults would hope for ourselves.
What are you discovering that your kids are passionate about that previously you might have been uncomfortable with, or maybe you still are, or is there something that is surprising for you?
So they're really into gaming.
All new at 6 o'clock. He is 16 years old and he spends more than 9 hours a day playing video games, but he's making a lot of money doing it.
The Sudbury teenager competes professionally, and as WBZ's Paul Burton shows us, his parents are his number one fans.
First thing in the morning, last thing before bed, you'll most likely find 16-year-old Jordan Herzog of Sudbury on his computer, headphones on, and laser focused.
I used to play sports, but that kind of fell through because I didn't really enjoy it as much, and I realized how much I enjoyed video games.
He's been playing video games since he was 3 years old. With quick wrists and fast fingers, he's now an esports professional athlete. The gaming world knows him as Crims. His favorite is the popular game Fortnite.
Fortnite is a 100-player battle royale. People drop into the arena. People try to survive, be the last team standing.
And he plays it all day long, which is why he's now one of the best in the world.
I play 10 hours a day of Fortnite. This year I'll be making around 100 to 150K at the minimum.
Now the Sudbury native is heading to the Fortnite World Championship competing for a $30 million prize pool.
First place gets $5.5 million. And so me and my teammate are preparing every single day.
His father, who's also in the gaming industry, recognized his talent. So he removed him from Lincoln Sudbury High School and enrolled him in online courses so he can spend more time practicing in his $20,000 game room.
Gaming chairs. The table alone is a $1,000 table that goes up and down. So he needs this precise height of the table so that his wrist can move a certain way.
Crims obviously spends endless amounts of hours in his gaming room here, and it appears to be paying off. His father says he earned $85,000 alone playing Fortnite right here, and this is just the beginning.
There's going to be 50 duos in one match, best of the best around the world. So it's going to be really tough, but if we do, we're going to make it big.
In Sudbury, I'm Paul Burton, WBZ News.
As a recovering Tiger mom, some of that is very triggering for me. Some of that does make me anxious because, you know, there's all this, you know, we pathologize video gaming and we have certain ideas, attitudes toward it. I'm really trying to resist that because one thing that people say, like when we talk about unschooling, is they're like, well, what if they sit around and play video games all day, as if that's like the worst thing that could happen, right? And that's what my kids do a lot of the time. But what I'm learning to do is to not see that as something bad, but to enter into it with them, to see all the learning that is happening. A lot of the time we see learning in very, what we call schoolish ways, you know, like you need to prove to me that you're learning something, you need to be learning in these certain areas. But learning is happening all the time. And I'm really amazed to see all the things that they are learning through the things that they're interested in, you know, just problem solving, math or geometry, coding, communication, like typing, because they're like typing all these things in the chat. So all these things that they are learning because they are motivated and excited about it. So instead of, you know, giving into my fear and anxiety, I'm learning to be more curious and more supportive and to understand how learning works outside the box.
One of my favorite philosophers, who's also Canadian, Marshall McLuhan, he said, anyone who tries to make a distinction between education and entertainment doesn't know the first thing about either.
Yeah, because I think it's also an attitude that we have maybe as tiger parents is that learning should be hard. Learning should not be fun. Learning should be difficult and grueling and require discipline. And I think it's, again, this sort of like unhealthy association that everything that is good should not feel good. That's just simply not true. Like, what if we pursued joy more? What if we pursued pleasure more? Like, not in a totally hedonistic way or whatever. But I think some of those attitudes are very puritanical, also associated with capitalism and suffering. And what if we were able to live more with flow instead of antagonistic approach to life and to self-improvement or all of those things? I think if we actually played more, had more fun, had more joy in our lives, like how much more efficient would we actually be? There's plenty of research that is showing that instead of working yourself to death, taking breaks and having vacation and all those things, even like working from home where you're more relaxed, can make you more quote unquote productive or efficient. So entertainment and education are definitely should be connected and integrated with one another.
One thing that you wrote that really resonated with me was, quote, growing up, I never knew I was allowed to want anything, unquote.
Mm-hmm.
When I went through my own burnout and crisis, I caught myself in this mania of should. What should I be doing? I also never knew anything about what I wanted. I didn't know about my own wants and desire and what is enjoyment. I didn't know about pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
All I knew was the bondage of should. Now, as an untigering mother, what do you find yourself enjoying now?
Yeah, that's a great question, because that's not something that I grew up asking myself ever. I think doing the work that I'm doing right now is something that I'm really passionate about and just gives me a lot of joy and a lot of purpose, you know, just sharing about peaceful parenting, sharing about the things that I've been learning through my untigering. So for me, that's something that really brings me joy, brings me purpose. But even in doing that, I always need to be asking myself to be in tune with my intuition, because there's so many opportunities out there, so many things I could be doing to get the message out there more, to earn more money or all those things. And I really have to be asking myself, is this aligned with who I am, with who I want to be, with the type of life that I want for myself? And it's still challenging because sometimes I don't know, you know, when we've grown up not being in tune with ourselves and our own desires or our own boundaries, it takes a long time to get in tune with that again. And I think school is also a part of that, where we are conditioned to give away our autonomy and to comply, to learn what are everybody else's expectations, and then to try to hit those marks instead of being self-motivated. So that's something that I really see with my own kids, where every day they get to ask themselves, what do I want to do with my day? You know, and just practicing those muscles of learning to be self-motivated, to be learn to be in tune with themselves, I think is amazing, because that's something that I never grew up with. But of course, that's always in the context of relationship too. That's something that I talk about in my book as well. There's the respect aspect, and then there's the relationship part of it, where because we are in relationship with one another, that doesn't mean you can just do whatever you want for the whole day. There are responsibilities to each other and ways that we want to stay connected to each other. So how can we just honor both those aspects of respecting your autonomy and yet still being connected with one another?
The release of your book has been received really well, as it's also very timely considering the history of the collective Asian diaspora. Has your book met any critics that finds the message difficult or confronting?
If you're not already warmed up to the message, I don't think you would read the book. So like hardcore tiger parents aren't necessarily going to read the book, right? So I don't feel like I have had too many critics. I did recently speak to, like, do a little webinar for a group of Chinese Australian parents who had maybe never heard of me before and were probably more on the tiger parenting end. And so I think even though they were very open, they just had a lot of questions like, how does this work? And what if your child won't listen to you, even though you have all this knowledge that they still lack because they're still young? So they're still coming at it from a very traditional tiger parenting, control, authoritarian mindset. And so it takes a lot to begin to shift, especially when nobody around you is doing anything like that. It seems very bizarre. So I think part of it is I really wanted to write this book as an Asian American, not just as somebody who was practicing peaceful parenting, but particularly as an Asian American, because I think there are unique challenges and unique obstacles that we need to overcome. A lot of cultural norms and pressures. And I am trying to get the book translated into Chinese. So maybe that's when I will get more pushback, but really hoping that more people will begin that shift, you know, even if it's a little bit. And I think part of it is just having somebody, seeing somebody else do it, to know that it is possible. The outcomes are so much better than what we've experienced in the past through tiger parenting. So I'm really hoping that the book will be that for different audiences who aren't quite on the same page.
That was Iris Chan, author of the book Untigering, Peaceful Parenting for the Deconstructing Tiger Mother. You can find out more about Iris Chan and her work by checking out this episode's link on AsianProvocation.com, where you can find all the links to this episode. Iris also holds webinars and a book club, where you are invited to join, which is starting on 8th of May. Asian Provocation is a queer conversational podcast sharing invisible ideas and stories with a focus on Asian diaspora. If you're enjoying this podcast, you can support me by becoming a Patreon for as little as $5 a month. Funds will go directly into running the show and to keep this an independent outlet for invisible ideas that you care about. Thank you so much for all of you who supports the show. Asian Provocation is produced by yours truly, Ayota Taraxia. Additional voicing by Liv Phoenix. Music by David Celeste and ELFL. And this is your host, Ayota Taraxia, signing out.